Well, welcome to another podcast here at the Sussex Cricket Museum. I'm Adrian Harms. I'm the BBC commentator on all Sussex games. And throughout this summer, we've been looking through the museum, looking at some of the exhibits and the fascinating history of this wonderful cricket club that's portrayed in the museum. So this is the final one we're going to do, or I'll be involved in this season. So I'd like to thank, first of all, Keith Ridge and Roger Packham, I'm with today. And we'll talk a little bit about what happens here in the winter at the end of this particular podcast. But first of all, Keith is the curator of the museum, Roger, author, and I'm going to call you a historian, somebody who knows virtually everything there is to know about this museum. We're in front of some cabinets here. Roger, just tell us about these cabinets, what's in them, and I'm sure they're huge relevance to the club.
Thank you, Adrian. Yes, they are of huge relevance to the club. They've been put together and assembled by Norman Epps and Keith here and the team, and they do show an awful lot of highly relevant things regarding Sussex cricket. And the one, are we going to talk about the one?
Yeah, well, they're in front of us. So just for the benefit of people who are listening, I mean, they are, you know, they're cabinets with all sorts of photographs in them. So perhaps we should start on the left and sort of work our way around here. Is that a good way of doing it?
Yes, we'll do that.
The first one, he talks about the formation of Sussex Cricket Club. Just tell us a little bit about this, because there's all sorts of, looks like newspaper extracts and photographs that are here.
Absolutely. Well, this commemorates the foundation of Sussex Cricket Club in 1839, claimed to be the oldest professional sports club in the world. And there are a lot of very interesting original pieces, like admission cards and letters admitting people to membership, and a picture of the old ground at Brighton, all assembled lovingly in one frame and donated to the club by Christopher Lee, who wrote from the Sea End for the club's centenary. Sorry, 150th, sorry.
Yeah, and some of the, articles from the Brighton Gazette.
Yeah.
I was looking here from the Brighton Guardian.
Yeah, Brighton Herald.
The initial dinner meeting, Sussex Cricket Club, 1839. I mean, when we think about, you know, these are nearly 200 years old.
Yes, they are indeed. We celebrated the 175th anniversary a few years ago with a coffee table book covering each decade of the club's existence. That was very well received. But this is a lovely framed content showing those origins. And it's as well to remember the driving force behind the club. And he was a young fellow of about 20 called George Langdon. And he had the enterprise to invite all the county gentry to participate in this venture. There had already been an earlier subscription list 3 years earlier of gentry, but this made a county club viable with a committee and so on. And young Langdon became, he took holy orders, and after a few years he leaves the club, and he spent a lot of time being the vicar at St Paul's Church in St Mary Cray. I think I've got the dedication right. So he was lost to cricket, but he is credited with sorting out and starting up the county club, 1839.
And actually, there's a picture here, and it says Royal Cricket Ground, now Park Crescent, in 1839. So that's not here.
That's not here. No, this is the Brighton Ground. This was a ground started by Ireland and known as Ireland's Gardens for a while. It became known as the Royal Gardens. And at this time, they're calling it the Royal Cricket Ground, quite correctly. Shown here in 1839 with this rather handsome saloon pavilion. You can still find parts of it today. There are some stone pillars known as the Lion Gates, still there in Union Street by the level. They were shown in some of these early illustrations. I can see them there on the left of the picture. So that was the ground at Brighton, and because of building development, the club had to leave this ground to find another ground, which is the one depicted in this cabinet.
Right, so we're moving around now towards some more pictures, and there's a beautifully framed photograph here in a wooden frame. I'll just read what it says. Photograph of a print of the Royal Brunswick Cricket Ground at Hove, used by Sussex from 1848 up to 1871, when the club moved to the present ground.
That's absolutely right. So it left Brighton and came to Hove for the first time, and at this Brunswick ground, cricket sort of developed, there were county games played here, and halfway through its tenure, Sussex County Cricket Club took ownership of the ground for the first time. That would have been in the 1860s here at the Brunswick. And the great thing about this ground, Adrian, that it was very close to the seaside. So it was due south of the present ground, due southwest probably, where 3rd and 4th Avenues now are. And you can see some ships on the sea there, little thatch pavilion. So you can see how close it was to the sea. And it was very famous, but W.G. Grace played here as a 15-year-old and scored 170.
Wow.
And 50-odd not out in the second innings.
Could you hit the ball from the ground to the sea?
Not quite. They reckon it was about 200 yards distance. Oh, okay. But you could certainly hit, and there are lots of reports of big hits at this ground, out of the ground, and so on. But it was a famous ground in its day. It was only there for 24 years, staging the county matches, but it also had other attractions. For instance, they had a cricket match there between the one arm against the one leg Chelsea or Greenwich pensioners.
Really?
Yes, and that was a very popular fixture. It was also played at Hastings and the Oval and Lords, and it was a big fixture, the one arms v the one legs. Yeah. And people came to rather mock these poor soldiers, these veterans, yeah. But they took it in good stead and probably made a few bob out of it. So that was one of the fixtures. The Australian Aborigines played on this ground in 1868, and they gave people an exhibition of their boomerang throwing and defending cricket balls with shields and spears and things. So they were an attraction. We had the famous Indian runner called Deerfoot, who's internationally known early long-distance runner. Deerfoot appeared here. We had Sanger's Circus. We had all sorts of things. A bit like now, you've got to make the ground pay for itself, so you get Elton John or somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
they were pioneering.
They were definitely pioneering how to make a ground pay for itself.
I mentioned this photograph here of Sussex County Cricketers 1864, and yep. I was just looking through the names. I mean, it's a wonderful black and white photograph. But there's a G. Wells here. I know the Wells family are hugely associated with Sussex. Yeah. Any relation?
He's not a relation, Adrian. He was George Wells, known as Tiny Wells, and he was tiny. He was born in the East End, but came down to Sussex as an infant, and he was a half-decent all-round cricketer, and he did go to Australia with one of the early sides in the 1860s. So quite a famous cricketer. And there are some good names in that side. The Sussex team of 1864, Lily White, who we're going to talk about in a moment, James there and John, and the great character in the back is Stubberfield, Henry Stubberfield, known as Old Stubber, an old Brighton boy, famous bowler in his day, quite likely to get into trouble, especially when he'd had a few drinks. But old Stubber is there, and he was a bowler for Sussex for many years, became a first-class umpire.
And the other picture in here that's interesting is a picture, I hope I pronounced this guy's name correctly, Charles Henry Gorsden.
Correct.
Who is sitting down. He looks a bit formidable.
He does
Charles.
Look formidable. Well, he is...
He looks like a headmaster or something.
Well, no, he's actually got his mayoral robes on. Right. He was mayor of Hastings on 3, if not 4, different occasions. But he's in this cabinet because when Sussex had to leave the Brighton ground that we've spoken about, he took the initiative, and it was his own initiative. He was a player. He was playing for Sussex at the time. Huge man. He was 6 foot plus when most guys were a lot shorter than they are today. And he developed this Brunswick ground on his own, so he had to do a lot of negotiating to get the lease. He had to do all the earth moving, and he had to get the approval of the Sussex authorities so that the county could come and play at the Brunswick ground. He only plays a handful of professional games for Sussex round about this time, and then he moves on, and we see him in Rye, and there was a family estate agent business, and he did very well in business and became mayor of Hastings.
And it talks about the Royal Brunswick ground opening in 1848. It says the lease expired on October the 1st, 1871.
Indeed.
And the last match of importance was for the benefit of John Lillywhite, we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yes.
Took place in August 1871, when 10,000 people attended.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
It only holds 6.5 here now, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yes, it does.
That's amazing.
That was a tremendous attendance, but he was a very popular man. The Lillywhite family did so much for cricket and for Sussex cricket in particular, and they wanted to pay their respects. I think they also wanted to come to see the famous old ground at the Brunswick before it was going to be broken up and the ground would be moved to its present site in 1872.
And for the benefit of people now, here we are in 2023, the Brunswick ground, what's on there now?
Well, it's 3rd and 4th Avenue, so it's a lot of houses, quite smart gentlemen's houses, but you can see the site of it. There used to be one or two relics relating to the ground, but I don't think they're there anymore.
Roger, did they move the turf from there to here?
They did, yes. That's thank you, Keith. Yes, there's a good story that the turf was taken up from the Brunswick, moved to this present ground. Perhaps we've still got it today. Yeah. So that's a nice bit of continuity. But otherwise, everything was demolished, including that there was a public house on the ground like there has been on this ground, and that was demolished.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Mm. Let's move to the next cabinet. I know it's not great radio talking about cabinets, but we are looking at cabinets. They're silver-framed cabinets and all sorts of exhibits in here. And this one perhaps dominated by a picture of Lillywhite. Tell us a little about Lillywhite and it looks like a house underneath it as well. So tell us a little bit about, is that James Lillywhite?
No, this is William Lillywhite. Okay. He is the father. He is the great Sussex bowler. Some people would say he's the greatest Sussex cricketer full stop.
Really? All time?
Of all time. Some people would claim that. He found out bowling. He was the pioneer of round-arm bowling.
Yeah.
But not just a pioneer, he had this great control over bowling. He could pitch the ball wherever he wanted to, and he could make it rise, and he could vary it, and he could sum up batsmen's weaknesses. He would work out what their strengths were, what their weaknesses were, and attack them accordingly, and he got a bundle of wickets. And this is a recent purchase by the museum.
The picture.
The picture showing this great man, William Lillywhite, known as the Nonpareil or Nonpareil, without parallel, a great bowler known throughout England for his bowling. And the name is still commemorated today. If you go up to Piccadilly Circus, what have you got? Lillywhite's huge store. And that is his family business coming down to the present day. Mm. They left legacy. We've spoken about wisdom previously. They all leave legacies, these great pioneers of Sussex cricket.
Is Lillywhite's store still open?
As far as I know, it's still open, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, don't you live and learn? Yeah. I wonder whether the family had a few quid, because this photograph, born June the 13th,
1792.
At Goodwood.
His father was a bricklayer to the Duke of Richmond at Goodwood.
Oh, right,
And William was also a bricklayer.
All right, okay. So bricklayers make plenty of money, but it's not like he came from aristocracy or anything.
No, absolutely the reverse. That thorough working class,
right.
Lots of agricultural labourers in the family, a very ordinary family, but hard working and a lot of enterprise. When you sort of develop ideas and promote things?
Yeah, entrepreneurial.
Entrepreneur is exactly the right word.
Right.
But so there he is in 1792. He is the father, he is the daddy of all this. But his career, he was still playing first-class cricket in his 60s. And they had a benefit for him at Lord's. Sadly, he was taken ill and could only bowl a few overs. And the story is that his friends had treated him too liberally before the match started, so he had to go off. But he was 61. But he was a great bowler. He also, apart from being a bricklayer, he changes careers. He takes a pub in Preston Street called the Royal Sovereign and a cricket ground up the road, which was Lillywhite's ground, quite near the Seven Dials. So entrepreneur is absolutely right. He was full of ideas, full of developing things. But then he has a dispute with the landlord and he leaves Lillywhite's ground in 1844 and moves to London. Then gets himself on the MCC staff, where he's highly valued, plays lots of matches for the MCC and develops his own sports goods business in Euston, in Islington, sending sports goods all round the world. Mm. If you see the sporting papers of the time, Lillywhite's, they advertised extensively sending sports goods, not just cricket, all sports, all round the world. They were a huge promoter of sport in 1850s, 60s and beyond, right up to the present day.
Actually, what I love about the story is that he didn't come from money as well. Because often you hear people who are around clubs or organisations, it's someone who's come from the aristocracy, who's born into money. It's really nice to hear, actually, about someone who wasn't.
It is, and it's the same with Wisden, it's the same with Tom Box. They were all good working clubs.
Yeah.
They relied on the aristocracy to fund the matches, set up the grounds, all this sort of thing. But they were working class, but they were hard working class.
I think if our listeners are interested, the Royal Sovereign, I think, still exists Preston Street.
Yeah, it does.
That's right.
Pub is still there, very famous for Lillywhite's tenure.
And just some of the exhibits are here. There's a green... How would you describe this? Not a notebook.
It's an annual. It's a cricket annual.
Thank you. I can't think... Right. Patron HRH, the Prince of Wales,
yes.
James and John Lillywhite's Cricketers' Companion, 1880, Lillywhite's Guide to Cricketers.
That's
incredible.
It is incredible, Adrian, and we've spoken about William Lillywhite. Well, he had three sons, that we might just mention briefly, but they were all involved in producing cricket annuals. This is part of the sports goods idea, promoting cricket, having... how we would now get our little Playfair annuals, looking up little biographies of all the players.
Sure.
They are in these. And the first of these comes out as early as 1845, Fred Lillywhite's Guide, a son of William. He started the guide in 1845. And then his brothers also got involved, and his cousin. So we got the Red Lillywhite and the Green Lillywhite. And they continued every year from 1845 right up to 1900. And by 1900, they couldn't stand the competition against Wisden's Almanac, who then had the field to himself. He started in 1864.
And I've got to ask here, there's a silver case. It looks a little bit like a sort of case perhaps you carry cigarettes around in something. I wonder what that is.
Well, it doesn't have a caption, Adrian, so I'm not entirely sure. You're right, it's either a cigarette case or a snuff box or something like that. It's silver. It's obviously been presented to one of the Lillywhites. I'll see if we can't get a caption there at some time. But the gentleman, I need to just talk, Adrian, behind the silver cask is James Lillywhite Jr. Okay, he's a nephew of William, and he is a very famous cricketer in his own right because he was the first England Test match captain. Took a side to Australia.
Of all time?
The very first Test match is England v Australia in Melbourne, March 1877. The England captain was James Lillywhite Jr. And there he is.
And I love those stories. Like 1877, it must have taken 6 months to get there, actually.
Well, it did. It took an awful long time out on a ship, and they're all being seasick, and then travelling around Australia, as you can imagine.
Well, just go from Melbourne to Perth. That would have taken you about...
Well, I think they gave Perth a miss in those days.
So in summary, the Lillywhite family, hugely influential in Sussex cricket and in the history.
Yeah, they really are, Adrian. And there's this little... drawing here shows Lillywhite at home. Well, this is in Wilbury Crescent. I think that's right, which is actually, it might not be, it's Wilbury something, Wilbury Road, Wilbury something. Wilbury Road, there we are. Wilbury Road, which is immediately behind the current pavilion.
That's right.
So this was the Lillywhite home, cottages. Yeah. This is where the boys were born. William had these three famous cricketing sons born here, and here they are. That's William bowling to his sons. You can see he's quite a junior. One of them keeping wicket, probably John Lillywhite keeping wicket, right here in Hove behind the present pavilion. Wonderful connection with early cricket and with the Lillywhites.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And Sussex are famed for having family.
They
the
are.
Wells, the Lenhams.
Absolutely.
So the Lillywhites would have been the first ones? The first sort of...
No, there are earlier ones, strangely enough. Yes, and there were Broadbridges at the same time.
Yeah.
But this continuity of families, fathers and sons, brothers, goes all the way through Sussex cricket. I just need to mention Fred Lillywhite. He was another son of William. This is him in his printing tent. Now, he did play a bit of cricket, nothing that's now considered first class, but he's made his mark because he had this printing tent that went all the way round the world so he could print scorecards. And he went to America with his printing tent. He went all round the British Isles with his printing tent, set it up on the ground so he could sell you a match card of the game. And there he was. And he also, he was another entrepreneur. He wasn't just a scorecard man. He published lots of books. Mm-hmm. He and his father got involved in the Scores and Biographies, which is the handbook of early cricket. Fred published those. And he was just amazing. He published prints of the early cricketers, beautiful prints that we still value today in that style. He must have engaged the artist, which is Corbett Anderson, to make these prints, and then he would sell them. But unfortunately, he died quite young, probably only about 40, penniless in Brighton. So it's a sad story. Mm. But his entrepreneurship, which includes these annuals, lives today. And that was Fred Lillywhite.
Mm. Amazing. Yeah. Well, that's been a really, really good insight, Roger. Can I first of all just thank you both? Because I confess I've been commentating on Sussex cricket now for the best part of 10, 11, 12 years. And because it's always busy and racing around, I haven't taken the time, shamefully really, not to come into the museum. So it's been wonderful for me to come in here and you two particularly showing me around some of these exhibits. And you know, hopefully there's been visitors who have come as well, because it's there's so much history in here. It's so thank you both very much. I just wonder what happens now in the winter and what do you guys do?
Well, after today, the real on season starts for the museum. Okay. Because we've got to dismantle the exhibitions that are coming down. A number of them will be changing. We've already got ideas for next season, so we've got to get the material out, we've got to find it, we've got to get it framed. You've already seen a bat today that's been given to us. And so all this work's got to be done. We've got an enormous amount of cataloguing which we need to do. We've just had a new computer system put in which will enable us to move forward in that way. Our book sales, which we've been doing through the season, have helped raise money, because we don't get money other than from selling books. So we'll be sorting all this stuff out during the winter months. So it's when the hard work is done, effectively. Mm. And in that respect, we're always looking for volunteers. People that can either use a screwdriver to take pictures down, people that want to do cataloguing, people that are into IT. There's numerous jobs. Nobody would be turned away. So we meet on generally a Wednesday or a Thursday in the closed season. If you're interested in joining us, everybody would be welcome. And you can either go on to the Cricket Museum website, which is sussexcricketmuseum.org, or you can contact me direct on an email, which is curator@sussexcricketmuseum.org, and we'll get back to you, and you'd be most welcome to join us. We do need more people, because even stewarding, we need a number of people here just to be in the museum and to answer questions. So, and your mentions, Adrian, during the season, which have been great, because it's encouraged people to come in, and as we found out earlier on, you know, Radio Sussex goes across the world in terms of the live stream. So, you know, the museum has had fantastic adverts from yourself. Mm. And thanks very much for that, and it's been great. So hopefully we'll see you again at the beginning of next season with some new exhibitions.
Wonderful. Well, great, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adrian. And, very much
winter well, as they say.
Indeed.
Thank you.
All the best.
Well done.